today on Against the Grain. Food affects all of us, but while it's a necessity for our survival, it's also a vast, sprawling industry spanning the globe, which generates enormous profits as well as significant damage to public health and the environment.
There are now literally hundreds of studies linking consumption of large amounts of ultra-processed foods to poor health outcome. And that means overweight, obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancers, behavioral problems, cognitive problems, early mortality, the whole works.
Nutritionist and molecular biologist Marion Nessel sheds light on the choices we must all navigate when we enter the grocery store. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When we go to the supermarket, we're confronted with a vast array of foods. Packaged, unpackaged, natural, organic, non-organic, foods with claims of being nutritious or sustainably farmed or endorsed by the American Heart Association. Packaged food calls out to us from the ends of the aisles, and gaudy displays are placed to trigger impulse buys. In the face of such onslaught, how should we make sense of it all? Marion Nessel is a founder of the Field of Food Studies. She's Professor Emerita of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, and her many books include Slow Cooked, Unsavory Truth, and the guidebook What to Eat, which she's updated and completely revised 20 years later. The new book is titled What to Eat Now, The Indispensable Guide to Good Food, How to Find It, and Why It Matters. When I spoke to Marion Nessel recently, I asked her what had changed in the world of supermarkets in the past 20 years. This was her reply.
Well, mostly it's easier to talk about what has not changed. And what has not changed is that the food industry, and that includes food companies and it also includes supermarkets, are businesses with stockholders to please. Their job is to sell as much product to as many people as often and at as high a price as they possibly can. That's the starting point. Once you understand that, everything after that makes sense. And what's changed in the 20 years since I wrote the first edition, then called What to Eat, is an enormous substitution of bottled water for full sugar sodas. That's a good change. The introduction of plant-based meats and dairy products, that's an okay change, depending on how you feel about it. The conversion of supermarkets from places where people come in and shop to places where shoppers are there all day long, putting things in bags for people who ordered them online, totally changed the way supermarkets are organized. The changes go on and on and on. Every single product I used as an example in the 2006 edition doesn't exist anymore. So the introduction of new products has been there, and the supermarket is now full of packages that tell you what is not in them. No gluten, no sugar, no high fructose corn syrup, no GMOs, whatever it is. Mostly they're advertising what's not there instead of what is there.
It's been noted that supermarkets like food companies pay for a lot of research to try and figure out how to best sell products to consumers, how to make food incredibly palatable or addictive and pull people in. And you just said that supermarkets have changed a great deal in the last 20 years. How have they changed, and are they still structured in a way to try and sell you as much food as possible?
Oh, absolutely. The book is about food issues and how to think about food issues using supermarkets as an organizing device. So what I did was to go around the supermarket aisle by aisle and talk about the issues that emerge that I think people want to know about when they're buying food, and the issues are complicated. The book is 700 pages. I mean, it's kind of amazing. But the basic structure is the same. They're trying to sell products. They want people to come into the store, spend as much time as possible in the store, look at as many products as possible, and put as many products as possible into the shopping carts. That's the whole point. And in order to get people to do that, and I cannot even begin to describe the quantity and depth of the research that goes into determining what encourages people to pick up one product rather than another, the supermarkets are set up so that the products that are likely to be most profitable are the ones that are most easy to see. They're at eye level. They're at the ends of the aisles. That's the name for that is end caps. They're in special freestanding sections, and they're at the checkout counter. And none of that is random. That's the thing that's so surprising to me that, you know, you just never think about. None of the placement of products in a supermarket is random. They're not just thrown there. They're there because research shows that if they are in those places, more people will see them and more people will buy them.
Well, you note in What to Eat Now that, you know, since you wrote What to Eat, there's been this real explosion of ultra-processed foods, and that, you know, shows up in the supermarket, things that are highlighted. How would you define ultra-processed foods, and what has driven their enormous proliferation?
Well, the same thing that drives the proliferation of anything else, and that is profit. And that's so interesting, because three papers from the British journal The Lancet, on which I am a minor co-author on two, have just come out defining ultra-processed foods as industrially produced for the purpose of generating profit and containing ingredients that don't look anything like the foods they came from, plus color, flavor, and texture additives. And their purpose is to get you to eat them, to get you to eat them over and over again, to be irresistibly delicious, some would say addictive, and to get you to eat more and more of them all the time. You can't eat just one, the old Lay's potato chip commercial. You can't eat just one. You have to eat the whole bag. And then when you finish the bag, you want another one. The whole point of that is to get people to consume these products.
And over the time that they have become more ubiquitous, can we see the fortunes of the companies that make them rise during that time? You know, how would you assess, stepping back for a moment and looking at the larger food industry, how that's affected its fortunes?
Well, the food industry as a whole accounts for trillions of dollars in sales in the United States alone. I mean, just unimaginable amounts of money. Everybody eats. Most people buy their food at supermarkets. The supermarket industry is highly consolidated. There are three or four companies that control most of the sales. Walmart alone is 25 to 30% of grocery sales in the United States. Almost impossible to imagine. And the companies that make the products that are on those shelves are also increasingly consolidated, so that they control what's on the shelves and the prices of those products. And if you think that supermarket prices have been going up lately, you would be absolutely right. And it's because there's very little competition among all of this. So we have a huge and very powerful industry, and interestingly enough, one that's in trouble now from some very surprising places. They're in trouble because the concept of ultra-processed foods is pretty well understood by a very large number of people, and people are starting not to buy so much of them. The supermarket industry is under siege because of RFK Jr., who came in on an agenda of fighting the food industry. Whether he's actually going to do that or not is another matter. And the new anti-obesity GLP-1 drugs are already seen to reduce drug takers' purchases of food in general, but of ultra-processed foods in particular. And then the whole business about inflation is hurting the food industry because people are shocked by how much food costs now.
So what are the established health effects of ultra-processed foods? What do we know about their impact on human health?
There are now literally hundreds of studies linking consumption of large amounts of ultra-processed foods to poor health outcome. And that means overweight, obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancers, behavioral problems, cognitive problems, early mortality, the whole works. Those are observational studies. That means they show a correlation between consumption of ultra-processed foods and bad health outcome, but they don't prove causation. But on top of that, there are now 5 or 6 controlled clinical trials, some of them in locked metabolic wards, that show that if you compare a diet that is ultra-processed with one that is based on minimally processed foods, you find that the people consuming the ultra-processed foods take in many, many, many more calories a day than they otherwise would, and they don't realize it. So that alone is a reason for advising reduced consumption of ultra-processed foods, because they make you eat more than you otherwise would and not realize it. You just don't realize it. So that's where the health issues come in.
Given that people have these concerns about the health effects of ultra-processed foods, what should we make of ultra-processed foods emblazoned with health claims or, you know, those that have endorsements from associations like, say, the American Heart Association?
Well, there's a clinical trial of those, too. Interestingly enough, there was a clinical trial done in Great Britain in which people who were at home, they were free living and were living at home, were given meals that were either minimally processed or they were given ultra-processed foods, but all of the ultra-processed foods that they were given were healthy ones. Or supposedly healthy ones. They were ones that were high in protein. They were ones that were high in fiber. They were ones that had endorsements on them. They were whole wheat breads. They were yogurts. They were all those kinds of things. And at the end of the trial, everybody in the trial lost weight. Both groups, the ones eating ultra-processed foods and the ones eating minimally processed foods, lost weight. But the people on the ultra-processed diet lost less weight. And what that tells me is that there's something about these products, even the healthy ones, that encourage people to eat more of them. They're formulated to get people to eat more of them. That's their point.
We're going to talk much more as we go about specific foods, and I should say that I'm speaking with Marion Nessel, Professor Emerita of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, about her book, What to Eat Now. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. Before we kind of drill down more to the food that one finds in the supermarket, and of course, as you note, the supermarket is not the only place food is sold to us, you know, from gas stations to convenience stores to, you know, wherever you look, there is food. But stepping back still for a moment more, when we're looking at this larger food system, which you say the most basic thing we need to understand is that it is profit-driven, that it doesn't have the best interests of our health at heart, how is waste built into the system and deeply embedded within it?
Oh, I think the food waste issue is really important. For one thing, it's something that individuals can actually do something about, so it's very satisfying in that way. But waste is built into our current food system. Our food system provides an average of 4,000 calories a day for every man, woman, and little tiny baby in the country. 4,000 calories is roughly twice what the the entire population needs on average. So we're, and I should say that that's an availability figure, that 4,000 calories. It's what's produced in the United States, less exports plus imports. It's what's available for consumption. So that means waste is built into the system. It also means that food companies are trying desperately to sell that food and not have it wasted. They want to sell it and make a profit off of it. So even if you are, even if you're overeating, you still can't eat 4,000 calories a day is really a lot. Now, of the waste that occurs, roughly 70% of that waste occurs at the production level. That is, it occurs as a result of bad weather or bad climate or disasters or fires or growing things that are not harvesting things at the right time or having the wrong size food or whatever. That's the main place where waste occurs. The second place is in the home, where 20% of the waste occurs in the home, and that's something you can do something about, but it's only 20%. And then the other 10% is in the supermarket. And interestingly enough, you think that supermarkets are wasting lots and lots of food, but in fact, their inventory control is so good these days that they've gotten it down to about 10%. And are doing a pretty good job of keeping waste to a minimum. And there are lots of public-private organizations and private organizations that are working on collecting wasted food from supermarkets, restaurants, institutions, and other places, and distributing it to places where it can be used. I think those are good initiatives.
Can you remind us of the environmental consequences of the food system as it exists today? Why does it have such a strong impact on ecological systems, and what sort of form do those impacts take beyond what you've just described about the waste?
Well, one is waste, obviously, but the other has to do with the enormous impact of the environment on the way we produce food. So roughly 45% of the soybeans and corn that are grown in the United States are used to feed animals, and that mainly means beef cattle, means beef and chickens and everything else. But beef cattle have the greatest impact on environmental emissions than any other food. And they produce environmental emissions because of the enormous amount of land that's used to grow the food that they have to eat, and also because they burp methane. And they produce vast amounts of waste that does not have to be composted before it's released into the environment. This is an absolutely unbelievably enormous problem that we have laws on the books, but the laws aren't enforced. And we really need a much, much more rigorous system of making the companies that produce animals in these confined animal feeding operations responsible for taking care of the emissions of their animals, if they're going to raise them that way. So the environmental impact, depending on who you ask, the environmental cost of food production is somewhere between 10% and 30% of the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that occur. I mean, it's right up there with transportation, but hardly anybody realizes that. We could do a much, much, much better job of raising food in a more environmentally friendly way and sustainable way, and we really need to do that.
Well, there obviously are some consumers who are worried about their food's impact on the environment, and there are certifications that products will have on them claiming that the company making the food hews to some sort of environmental standards. Do you think those are positive, or should we put that in the category of just another form of marketing?
Well, it's both. it's very difficult to know which of the certifiers is doing a really terrific job unless you do your own investigation. But I'm very much in favor of third-party certification. I think it's a really good idea. And I hope that the third-party certifiers are doing a good job. I mean, what impressed me about it is that there is no one certifier that takes care of all of the issues. There are many, many, many different kinds of certifying organizations, many of which put their stickers on various food products. And unless you're really doing a lot of research on it, it's very difficult to know which ones make the most sense and which ones are doing greenwashing. There's a great deal of greenwashing going on right now, and usually it's the companies that are doing it. So you always want to know who is behind the certification.
Well, I have to ask you the obvious question, which is for people who don't want to consume pesticides or want, you know, the workers who make the food, grow the food, and other living things be exposed to pesticides, what does the certified organic seal mean? Does it mean what I think a lot of consumers assume it means, that these foods are free of harmful pesticides?
Well, they're free of most harmful pesticides, and there's no question about that. When there are comparisons of the amount of pesticides in organic versus non-organic, the organics always have fewer of the harmful ones. They have pesticides, but they don't have the most harmful ones. And when they do, they have much lower levels. And that's because organics is a production value. It's about how food is produced. And the organic foods have to be produced without a great big long list of harmful pesticides. They can't be fertilized with sewage sludge. Ooh, was that a good rule? And they are really profiting from that now that we're finding huge areas of the country ruined because they used sewage sludge as fertilizer, and the things that they grow on it are full of heavy metals and toxins. It's really amazing. And the third one is that they can't be genetically modified. And, you know, most of the studies of organic show that the organic rules that are set by the Department of Agriculture, which I will say right off the bat is not the best place to house the National Organic Program, because the Department of Agriculture couldn't care less about anything except production and agriculture. But there it is, and there are rules, and those rules are enforced, and places are inspected. And in general, I would say in general, the system works pretty well. Are there flaws in it? Yes, indeed there are. But in general, it works pretty well, and I'm greatly in favor of organic. I'd actually like to see even more organic food being done, and I'd like to see the rules made even more strict so they follow the standards of the Real Organic Project, which insists that they be grown regeneratively as well, and defines regeneration as putting back into the soil what needs to be put back into the soil.
Mary Nessel, you just mentioned heavy metals in foods, and recently there's been quite a bit of attention to levels of lead and cadmium in chocolate, including in organic chocolate. Apple juice is another thing that there's been attention about lead in apple juice. Are there any regulations that oversee heavy metal contamination of food, you know, including, because it seems like the organic standards don't seem to pick up on that?
Well, there are, as far as I know, the amounts that are in these things they don't exceed what the standards are. So they're a standard set that you're not supposed to sell food that goes above those standards. Occasionally, foods are found that have too much of them. I mean, the real issue these days is infant formula. You know, where heavy metals have been found in infant formula. Infant formula has been contaminated now with botulism. You know, we have a food safety system in this country that is actually pretty good if you just look at the rules. But those rules have to be enforced. And we don't have regulatory agencies that are doing nearly a good enough job of enforcing the food safety rules, in my view. The idea that there's botulism in infant formula, are you kidding me? There have been 31 kids so far, infants, who have been affected by this. This is terrible.
How much does that regulatory system scrutinize foods, say processed foods, that are coming from abroad versus whatever is manufactured in the U.S.?
Well, that's part of the problem. The FDA is under-resourced, and it's particularly under-resourced for enforcement. So they've just, the administration has just cut the FDA's budget for inspecting international imports. We get a very large amount of our seafood and fresh fruits and vegetables from international countries. And if there isn't adequate inspection, the suppliers of these things will get sloppy. If they're not being watched, they'll get sloppy. And that's what happens when food producers get sloppy is that people get sick.
I'm speaking with molecular biologist and nutritionist Marion Nessel, author of What to Eat Now, which updates her influential book from 20 years ago, What to Eat. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. You just mentioned, Marion, fish and seafood, and I wanted to ask you about fish. There are various health benefits associated with fish and also a number of dilemmas posed by eating fish. Starting with the first, what are the claims for health benefits from fish consumption, especially around consuming omega-3s, which are high in some fish like sardines and salmon and mackerel, fatty fish?
Well, that's the big selling, the big nutritional selling point for fish, is that it has what are called omega-3 fatty acids in the long chain form. Fish are the greatest single food source of long chain omega-3 fatty acids that are very much associated with good health, with prevention of heart disease, and with a lot of other benefits. We get omega-3 fatty acids from vegetables as well as fish, but they're in a smaller form and they have to be elongated in the body. We do a great job of elongating short-chain omega-3 fatty acids, but it takes a long time. Once we have them elongated, however, they hang around for a long time. So fish are not actually essential. If you think about it, there are whole populations in the world that aren't anywhere near water sources that have a lot of fish in them. So fish are not an essential nutrient. They're not, you don't have to eat fish. It's just a really nice way to get omega-3 fatty acids, and also fish are delicious, and they have other nutrients as well, and they're not very high in calories, and their fats are not saturated. There are all kinds of reasons for eating fish if you like them, but they're not essential. Green vegetables are much more essential than fish are, because they have the short-chain omega-3 fatty acids.
Well, what about this question of mercury contamination? How widespread is it among fish, and how serious is it?
Well, it's very serious, because you can't do anything much about it. I mean, the thing about mercury, and it's not mercury, it's methylmercury that's a problem, but we get mercury in the environment from two sources: volcanoes, which you can't do anything about, and coal-burning power plants, which you most definitely can do something about. And what happens is that coal-burning power plants spew mercury into the environment. It's heavy. It falls down on the ground. The rain comes. The rain washes it into streams. It goes into the ocean. And in the ocean, there are bacteria and microorganisms in the ocean that can convert mercury to methylmercury, which is extremely toxic. And you could probably remember, you've seen the photographs of people in Minamata, Japan, where there was a lot of mercury spewed into the environment around there, and lots of kids got terrible neurological problems from that. Those are famous photographs. So you don't want to eat a lot of seafood with methylmercury. And the way it works is that if you're eating fish that are low on the food chain, they're small fish, they're anchovies or, you know, little things like that, they don't accumulate much. The fish that pose a problem from methylmercury are the very, very large predators. Little fish are eaten by bigger fish who are eaten by bigger fish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's things like sharks and tilefish and other things that I've never heard of that are really the big problem when it comes to methylmercury. And if you're going to eat those fish, you shouldn't eat very much of them. The big arguments are about tuna, because the big tuna accumulate, the albacore tuna, accumulate mercury, not as much as the really bad fish, but maybe half as much. Still much, much more than the smaller ones. And you don't want to eat too much albacore tuna because it will expose you to a lot of methylmercury, which fortunately goes away if you stop eating it in a few months. So my recommendation would be to eat small fish.
What about the farming of fish? One sees a lot of this, say, with salmon, and their contamination by toxic PCBs and other nasty chemicals.
Well, same thing. If they're in the ocean and they're in places where there's a lot of toxic waste being dumped into the ocean, they're going to pick it up. Oh no, and they're concentrated in one area, so they're only, and they're fed, and it depends a lot what they have depends on what they're fed. You know, it's the PCBs accumulate in the fat. The methylmercury accumulates in the muscles. That's why that's a problem in the big fish. But the PCBs accumulate in the fat. So if you don't eat a lot of fatty fish, it's not as much of a problem. And the farming, you want these things tested. And I would say about the methylmercury that all political attempts to get coal-burning power plants to clean up their emissions have failed. And the EPA has just said that it's going to back off of trying to get that done, which is interesting because when Robert F. Kennedy Jr. came in, one of the things he talked about was getting rid of mercury in fish. And he, like everybody else, has been unable to get those emissions turned off.
So where does that leave someone who may want to buy fish but faces a range of, you know, contaminants? Should they just stop eating fish? Or you mentioned small fish, but that doesn't necessarily save you with the PCBs.
Well, you want to eat fish in as wide a variety as possible, like everything else. I mean, the solution to many of the problems about food is not eating too much of any one thing, and eating small amounts of a very large number of foods. That's one way to make sure you get a nutritionally adequate diet, and it's also a very good way to avoid problems. You know, when it comes to fish, because I can't tell one fish from another once it's been filleted, you know, they're either pink or they're white, that's it. I don't know how to tell them apart once they're filleted, and even if they're not filleted, I'm not that familiar with fish. I think it's really important to buy fish from a reputable fish seller who is careful about where the fish are sourced from and usually works with third-party certifiers. Seems to me that's a really good way to do that. That's the best you can do. Why not?
I was going to ask you about meat, but I guess I really want to ask you, to what degree do you think people should be consuming meat in the first place? And then if they have to, how should they do it?
Well, I'm not much of a should person. People can eat what they like. There are really infinite ways of putting together healthy diets. Some of them include meat, some of them do not. There is no one food that is essential in the human diet. It's always possible to get nutrients, the nutrients that you need from many different kinds of foods. And if you look at the history of traditional foods in the world, they vary enormously in the basis of their calories and the kinds of things that they prioritize. Eat a variety of foods, don't eat too much, and stop worrying about it. enjoy your dinner. Food's one of life's greatest pleasures. And if there's anything we need these days, it's a source of pleasure. And if food can do it, I'm for it. So when it comes to meat, I think a lot of people in the United States eat more meat than is necessary. And certainly from a climate change standpoint, it makes sense to cut down on beef. That doesn't necessarily mean no beef, although I know there are a lot of people who feel very strongly that you should not eat beef at all. But I don't feel that strongly about it. I try to buy beef that's been raised on pasture, not in a CAFO, when I can. But maybe just cut down on it. Vary it with other kinds of meats. Vary the foods that you eat. Are vegetarian diets healthy? Absolutely. Are vegan diets healthy? Absolutely, if people who are on diets where they don't eat any animal products at all, make sure they get a source of B12 and make sure they're eating enough calories. I mean, there are ways around all of this. I'm not in favor of restrictive diets because I like food too much.
What about oils? Obviously, when you go into the supermarket, there's a range of oils that you can find, some promoted for their health benefits. Do you take the same attitude to oils, that people should have a range, or some better than others?
You know, the seed oil thing has gotten completely out of hand. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says that seed oils are poison and should be replaced by beef tallow. I'm not aware that the evidence on the qualities of various kinds of fats has changed, but that's his belief system. Okay, I don't see much evidence for it. You want to be careful with highly unsaturated seed oils to make sure they don't go rancid. They should be in dark bottles and they should be kept in the refrigerator. That would help them last longer. Most of the evidence says that if you eat seed oils as a replacement for harder fats from animal sources, you reduce your blood cholesterol and heart disease risk, and I don't see that evidence changing. You know, again, it depends on what you are looking for. I like the taste of olive oil, so I like to use olive oil, but I've used the more unsaturated ones. I want to make sure they're fresh. And I want to make sure they're in dark bottles so that light doesn't get at them. But, you know, eat what you like. Vary them. Variety is always a good principle.
Well, you mentioned rancidity. And one thing, I don't know if this is still as much a concern. I remember reading 15 years ago about concerns of counterfeit olive oil coming from elsewhere that has been doctored with, I don't know, hazelnut oil or something. Oils on the shelves often have passed their shelf life. Is that widespread? Is that just my perception?
I don't know. I mean, I try to buy olive oil that's pretty good because I don't buy very much of it, and I like a really good extra virgin olive oil. You can pay an enormous range of prices for olive oil, and the basic olive oils have been stripped in various ways so that they don't spoil and become rancid very easily. They've got preservatives in them. You want to look and see, if you can, whether there's a sell-by date. And usually it's about 2 years with olive oils. They can last about 2 years. So I don't know. That's not been my experience.
Let's turn to what you call in your book, techno foods. They're a range of foods that are created in labs, well, I guess a lot of foods are, but that often have particular promises attached to them. So one of them is plant-based meats. What do you think of plant-based meats, given that, you know, you were talking about the impact on the climate of especially beef? Do plant-based meats fill the gap? Are they problematic in their own right?
Well, they're ultra-processed. And you know, and they're complicated. They're long lists of concoctions. I have a food rule. I don't eat anything artificial. I think plant-based meats are artificial. I'm not interested in them. I'm not interested in eating something where the first ingredient is pea protein. If I want peas, I'll eat peas. I think peas have perfectly lovely protein. I don't need to have it isolated. So I'm not very interested in plant-based meats. Are they an enormous benefit for climate change? I don't know the answer to that. I wish we had a set of unified, agreed-upon criteria for how to measure effects on climate and the environment, but we don't. So how much good they do depends on who's doing the measuring at this point. They're advertised and marketed as a substitute for beef. Okay, beef are the biggest contributor to greenhouse gases, so any substitute might be better. And for people who are animal welfare and animal rights advocates, anything that prevents you from eating meat is a good thing. So these products have benefits for people with those kinds of belief systems. Whether they have benefits for the world as a whole, I don't think we know yet.
I'm speaking with Mary Nessel. She's a nutritionist, molecular biologist, author of What to Eat Now. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you write in What to Eat Now that basic dietary guidelines that there's a huge consensus on is that people should eat more plants. And I wanted to ask you about the plants that we find in supermarkets in the produce section, whether they're organic, non-organic. When you have looked at this question, how fresh is this stuff? And does it matter, or is it widely variable?
Yeah, it matters for taste more than anything else. I think supermarkets, at least the ones that I've seen, even the not so very good ones in New York, seem to do a pretty good job on produce. But one of the things that I did for the first edition of What to Eat 20 years ago was I talked to people about how long it took. I was once in a meeting in a broccoli warehouse in the Salinas Valley, and I wondered, the broccoli there was absolutely delicious. It was sweet and crisp, really fabulous. And I thought, I wonder how long it takes this broccoli to get to my local supermarket in Manhattan. And it turned out to be about 2 weeks. I was kind of shocked. You know, I mean, there's a lot of trucking involved. There's at least a week of trucking involved. And then there's all the other problems. So it's not fresh and it doesn't taste as good. And that's the biggest problem. Isn't it nice that we have all these farmers markets? Oh, and one of the things that always amazes me when I go to California is how good the food tastes. It's just so much better than what we can get on the East Coast.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, RFK Jr. came in with all sorts of promises about, you know, overhauling our food system, of addressing the chronic illnesses that are fueled by things like ultra-processed food and obesity more generally, part of this right-wing Make America Healthy Again focus. How do you assess that movement and its success and chance of success, I guess, if it's too early to judge its success now?
Yeah, it's pretty early to tell. RFK Jr. came in with a very, very long agenda related to food, some of which was terrific and some of which was eye-rolling. And all of it has to be understood in the context of what he's doing about vaccines, which you can never forget. And I was pretty interested in a lot of the things he talked about at first. He wanted to reduce consumption of ultra-processed foods. He wanted to get color additives out of the food supply. And he wanted to revamp the FDA's assessment of additives through the generally recognized the SAFE system. And I have to say, on those last two, the grass list and the color additives, he's done a pretty good job. Many food companies have agreed to remove their artificial color dyes from their products and replace them with vegetable dyes. Okay, M&Ms with vegetable dyes will still be M&Ms. Fruit Loops with vegetable dyes will still be Fruit Loops, but at least the artificial ones that are problematic will be out of the food supply. So that's a MAHA win. Another MAHA win is that the FDA is going to do a better job, it says, of evaluating food additives before they get into the food supply. So that's good. A third MAHA win is President Trump got Coca-Cola. I can't even say this with a straight face. President Trump got Coca-Cola to agree to replace high fructose corn syrup with cane sugar. That is nutritionally hilarious because they're the same glucose and fructose and they're the same calories. It's still going to be Coca-Cola. So, okay, whatever. Apparently, the big cane sugar lobbies got to Trump and got him to get that done. So, I don't know. That kind of thing seems like marginal issues to me. There was initially talk about restrictions on marketing of ultra-processed foods to kids. You don't hear anything about that anymore. You barely hear anything about ultra-processed foods. The only thing that the government has said it's going to do is to try to define it better. I think we're well past that point. We need to do something about it. There's nothing about, you know, nothing about getting ultra-processed foods out of schools, nothing about revamping the school meals to make them healthier. RFK Jr. has said they're going to prioritize whole foods. That sounds good. And they're going to prioritize meat and dairy products and saturated fat. I'm not sure that's such a good idea. I don't think the science has changed on that. The Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, has said that the dietary guidelines will no longer reflect leftist ideology. Leftist ideology? When did the dietary guidelines ever reflect leftist ideology? I was just stunned by the statement.
And I guess that intersects with the interest of some sectors of the right in this sort of masculinist culture around meat, that I guess meat is macho.
Meat is macho. Meat is red state, plants are blue state. I don't know. I mean, everything is polarized these days. And diet is polarized, too. Anyway, I tried to write all about this stuff in my book.
What about warning labels on ultra-processed food, for example, as some countries use to flag foods that are loaded with sugar or salt? I believe Chile pioneered that. How effective has that been elsewhere?
Well, there are lots of Latin American countries that now do that, and there are studies that show that it reduces sales of those products. That's un-American. The food industry here is totally opposed to it. Interestingly enough, the Biden administration proposed a warning label. I thought a very weak one that everybody would ignore, that proposal is still making its way through the FDA. We don't know what's happened with it. They haven't said anything about it. But we're waiting for action from the government on some of these issues. And who knows how it's going to come out.
If you had the ability to push through meaningful reforms to the food system, what would be at the top of your list?
Oh, I would, first of all, totally reorganize the agriculture system to produce food for people rather than feed for animals and fuel for automobiles. If you look at corn produced in the United States, more than 45% of it goes to feed animals. More than 45% of it goes to produce ethanol, leaving very, very little food for people in that. And the same thing is true of soybeans. I think we need an agricultural system that focuses on food for people. It would make a big difference. We need smaller farms to be producing fruits and vegetables, grains, beans, and nuts. And that might help repopulate the Midwest. That would be a very good thing. We need to stop marketing companies from marketing ultra-processed foods to kids, for sure. There have been attempts to do that over the years, year after year after year. They've gotten nowhere. This administration actually has the power to do it. I wish they would. We need warning labels. We need better labels. We need taxes on unhealthy food and subsidies for healthy food. We need a complete revamping of our food system, one that focuses on public health and environmental health.
Well, let me end with this question, which is definitely a political one. Now, at least going back to the 70s through the 80s and 90s, you know, speaking of left-wing food ideas, concerns around food, the food system, were a part of the wider world of the left. And it seems like a lot of concerns around big agriculture, also big pharma, have been taken up by sectors of the right. And I wonder if you feel like there is still momentum for progressive change around food, if these things have been captured, or maybe you don't think that's sufficient to derail it. You know, how do you feel about the potential for there to be, not necessarily in this administration, going into the future, progressive social change around food?
Well, the Maha Moms movement has a lot to be said for it. And, you know, I see real connections with some of the issues that that movement is concerned about, and that the left and the right can agree about a lot of those things. But my understanding now is that RFK Jr. is going to drop food and focus on drugs. You know, but again, until they actually do something, it's hard to know. And we don't know what people are doing. I'd like to see the food movement, such as it is. I mean, there are thousands of organizations working on food issues in the United States. I want to see them join together, collaborate, connect, act as a coalition, pick issues that they agree about, and start working on those issues so they become a real political force. When students ask me what they can do to change the food system, I say, please, run for office. Get some power.
Marian Nestle, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Marian Nestle is a molecular biologist, nutritionist, professor emerita of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU, author of What to Eat Now, which updates her influential book from 20 years ago, What to Eat. Her many books include Food Politics, Slow Cooked, and The Fish Counter, and she writes at the blog foodpolitics.com. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.